going to start in chapter 11. We're past that. Scott got past that. But there's a line in there that I want you to notice in particular that's relevant to what we're doing tonight. There's a line there in chapter 11 I want to go back and look at real quick to set up what we're doing tonight. And while you're finding chapter 11, my thanks to Scott, who is or is not in here. He's not coming to this class anymore, apparently. Well, you know, Scott, bless his heart, I was just a couple of you. I mean, Scott got morning barbie for me. He was supposed to sub for me last Sunday. I was supposed to be back in time for class Wednesday night, though. After Scott agreed to do something, I told him I'm really going to be pushing it on my plane flight. So there is an off chance you might have to. You tell them that after they say yes to the first one. Bless his heart, Scott already agreed. And so sure enough, I had a disaster getting out of Birmingham at the airport and just flight delays and whatnot. And so I had to text him literally from the plane saying, I think it's you tonight. So bless his heart, he stepped up very last moment to cover that for me as well. And so now he is in Bannon's class. apparently, I don't know. But I do appreciate him doing that. And I'm thankful for all the men who are able and willing to do that kind of thing. So anyways, you've got chapter 11 by now. Let's start with a word of prayer. Eric, can I ask you to say that?
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this time that we can come and study from your word. Please help us to have open minds, open hearts to receive what we hear and discuss. Lord, we know that we often fail you. We ask for your forgiveness. Please guide us and help us to be bright, shining lights to this world. It's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen.
All right. So you're in chapter 11 there, and just to kind of, again, get our minds back in what's going on here, chapter 7 through 12, very much kind of the heart of the message of Isaiah, in which the basic dynamic of human desire to trust in what you see, Ahaz wants earthly allies rather than trusting in God. Isaiah is sent to Ahaz to say, you've got the greatest ally of all. You've got God. Ask for a sign to comfort your heart in this difficult time of invasion. And Ahaz, says a very pious thing, but in reality he doesn't want a sign, he wants human allies. And so God gives him the great sign of what we now call the virgin birth, which ironically is a future king, not you, is going to do better than you do, if only you would stay faithful to God. And then the rest of 7 through 12 kind of bounces back and forth between these dark passages of coming judgment, and the world's going to get worse before it gets better in one sense, with these glimmers, chapter 9, chapter 11, of the coming messianic kingdom, of what this virgin-born child is capable of when he comes into his own. And this is how God is going to bring peace on earth, goodwill to men. This is how God is going to set all things right. This coming miraculous descendant of the line of David, ironically, of the line of Ahaz. And Ahaz, if this one is coming, then Ahaz is secure now. God's not going to let the story end this way. And so you just need to find faith. You don't have faith, you won't stand at all. And there's a pun there in Hebrew, but that's really the time and the place we've really got to move on. The quarter's getting away. Second Sunday of October already. In chapter 11, then, coming to this section in the line I want you to see real quick. Obviously this is one of the great, messianic passages, the lion laying down with the lamb and just the beauty of this branch that will come from the stump of Jesse, and the utopia, the wonderful existence that the Messiah will bring. And of course, he's not even talking about what Jesus did on earth. That's part of what the mistake the Jews made. That's why they were so disappointed when Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. He's talking about eternity is what he's really talking about, when, again, all sin is dealt with, which means no more violence, no more destruction. Animals don't try to eat each other anymore. I mean, it's a picture of peace and harmony like you had in Genesis. We forget the world wasn't created that way, and so that's very much the image that Isaiah is giving. So you're reading through all that, and that's all good news, that's wonderful. But part of this portrait that is painted of the wonderful time that awaits the people of God through the Messiah, I'm going to pick up in verse 11, and the phrase, in that day, appears there. You see that whenever you see that phrase, in that day, or in those days, or something like that, that's almost always in the prophets, a cue that you are into messianic age stuff. Nothing's going to happen in this life. Stuff that's going beyond. In that day, in those days, in the last days, in the latter days. But whenever that kind of language is invoked, that we know we're in a key change moment. If this were a piece of music, this is a key change. And in that day, verse 11, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people. And that's, I think that remnant concept is familiar to most of us, that the righteous few, even among the nominal people of God, are, you know, God knows who they are, they'll be saved in the end. And so verse 12, he'll raise a signal for the nations and will assemble the banished of Israel, gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And the jealousy of Ephraim shall depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Remember, this whole section started back in chapter 7 with the strife between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom over what to do about Assyria. Anyways, but if we kept reading, you get all the way down to this picture of the beauty of what's coming. Verse 16, the very end of that chapter. Here's why we're here. He says, and there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people, as there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt. And so keep this image that he gives us here of what's going to happen when God sets all things right. There's going to be an ancient interstate. They didn't have interstates back then. You know, but there's going to be this highway. What he wants you to understand is it's like God is going to facilitate, let's use the interstate idea, that runs, in a sense, from Assyria. And why Assyria? Well, because that's the great evil power that day. That's you know, Isaiah will prophesy about Babylon, but Babylon's a nobody yet. In fact, Hezekiah will be happy to make a deal with Babylon in his day because they're not dangerous. Assyria's what's dangerous. You know, so this is well before the rise of Babylon. Assyria is the big bad guy on the block. So a highway that runs from Assyria. But you notice what he connects it to. He connects it to Egypt. And so in one sense, a couple things are going on here. Number one is the image of like, almost like a second Exodus, right? God's people were captive in Egypt. And what does God do in the days of Moses? This great Exodus. And if, you know, it would have been a much faster trip to the promised land if they hadn't done what they did and turned into a 40-year debacle. Just like your road trip sometimes. No. But you get the idea. Because we forget. God actually, the journey originally, that first Exodus generation goes from Egypt, stays at Sinai until God gets through telling him he wants to know it's Sinai. Then they go straight to Kadesh Barnea in the book of Numbers. And all that's within 15 months. And it's not even because the journey itself had to take 15 months. It's because they spent 11 of those months at Sinai. So that's the thing. They could have been, you know, and again, when you're moving a multitude across the desert, I mean, you're not going to do it in 2 days. They could have been in Israel a long time before. You know, you leave in May, you're there in September. They could have been there. Why, you know, so the highway concept, you know, I'm going to move you in a quick and no-frills way. And so just like I've done from Egypt, I'm going to do from Assyria. And so you have this image of course, where are God's people always supposed to wind up? In a city called by his name, in Jerusalem. But I'm going to build the interstate. And my people are going to find their way when I set all things to right. That image of a highway that runs, in a sense, from Assyria to Egypt, I want you to hold on to that. Because we're going to see that again where we are now. And so we turn the page to the next section. We're in chapter 13. And what happens here in 13 through 23, is we have then God's judgment upon the nations. And he's going to pick certain nations in particular. He's going to, ironically, of all things, start with Babylon. Why would he do that? We'll talk about that in a minute. He'll talk about Babylon. He'll talk about Assyria. He'll talk about more local problems like Philistia and Moab. He'll talk about Damascus and Israel, who are currently, you know, at least most recently, in an alliance against Jerusalem to replace Ahaz. He'll talk about the big threats like Assyria and Babylon, though they don't realize Babylon's a threat yet. He'll talk about the local threats, and then they'll finish with Egypt of all things. Why Egypt? Because Egypt, ironically, in both the days of like Ahaz and the Assyrian crisis, as well as later in the days of the Babylonian crisis, those nations always, not the scale, Tigris and Euphrates, Persian Gulf. You know, then you got Egypt over here, that's your Nile River. And Jerusalem says right here. And so whether you're talking about Nineveh, whether you're talking about Babylon, the trouble always came from that direction. And so the direct trouble from that direction, where and all your enemies are up here, where do you go for alliance and help? You go to Egypt. You go down here to Egypt. And why would Egypt want to help you?
Because they're next in line.
Because yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it's not pure motives. Though they were always happy to take a paycheck for it, and that was always part of it. And various Judean kings would offer Egypt money, would try to buy them off. But Egypt did have a vested interest in it as well, which is I like a nice buffer here against, you know, which is why we still live today, right? We talk about proxy wars where we'd rather, you know, what was the whole rationale behind the war on terror? We'd rather fight them over there than here, right? I mean, so you know, that's not a modern idea. That's an ancient. So Egypt's happy to get involved. So one of the things that has to be clear to God's people is do not trust in Egypt. They're just as much trouble as you are and everybody else is. There is no answer in Egypt. And so that's the fifth. There are five nations, really, in this most immediate section we're about to look at, which runs from 13 to 20. Five nations, Babylon, and we'll put Assyria in parentheses, Philistia, Moab, Damascus, and Israel's partnership, and then Egypt. But that's why Egypt makes the list. And by the way, even after the Old Testament period's over, the idea of God's people caught between northern oppressors and southern oppressors, that goes all the way through the Greeks until the Romans come. That's a story that's not told in the Bible, but they are literally a political football fought over and jerked around by powers in Egypt and powers in Damascus all the way until the Romans come. So this is a very familiar dance that they are doing here.
And beyond.
As far as?
As we move into later history, past Rome, there's a football.
Well, yeah.
Even in World War I, there was.
Well, that's right. That's right. And if anybody wants to make sense of the headlines of the past 24 hours, the truth of the matter is this is World War I continuing. We miss that. World War II was World War I continuing. But it's not history class. We'll talk about that some other time. But when at the end of World War I, when the intellectuals redrew the map of the Middle East, they did it wrong. And we are literally still paying for that. Here we are over a century later. Yeah?
I was going to just ask about the highway analogy a little bit.
Sure.
Wouldn't that also mean that Israel or the land of Israel would be like the economic powerhouse at that point? Because if you're thinking about highways and how in the ancient world, that's how money moved, right? It was along the road.
Well, sure.
And so if you're in the middle of this great highway that connects Egypt wealth to Assyrian wealth,
right?
If you're in the middle, aren't you getting the benefit? And that kind of seems like what we get in Revelation, where all the wealth of the nations
pours in. That's right. Yeah, that image. That's right. No, I think it's part of, you know, so it's again, it's one of those, God takes an earthly reality, and we miss this sometimes. Part of the blessing of God giving Israel, his people, that land, it really was the crossroads of the world as the world developed. Because to Eric's point, Egypt, you know, and all of Africa, for that matter, comes up through here, you know, and the rest of the Middle East comes through here. And in fact, that's why, I did another class for the other day, the area of Megiddo, the ancient city of Megiddo, was so fought over, and it becomes even an image in the book of Revelation, the Battle of Armageddon is Har Megiddo, the Mount of Megiddo in Hebrew. So Armageddon is just a Greek form of the Hebraic Megiddo area. And that's because that was a mountain pass, actually. If you've ever been there, you've seen the wide Jezreel Valley. And that was basically a crucial pass for all of the ancient world if you're trying to get down to Egypt along the coastline. And that's why there's so many battles, including World War I battles, were fought there all the way into modern times because of the strategic importance of that. So that's the irony. But what God does, and let's keep in mind one of the other images we've already been given in Isaiah, back in chapter 2, the very beginning. You know, he goes from the earthly political and economic reality of why nations would fight over Israel's land and want to take it away and then use it for their own purposes or control it, to the larger issue, which is spiritually, if God wants to shine a light to the world, why not put it there? Why not put it there and let the world come through and hear about God? And so ironically, the flow switches with the coming of God spiritually. Whereas before, it's like, you know, basically Israel being stripped and torn apart by the world politically, economically, and militarily. In the work of the Messiah, then the world pours in there to hear the law of God and ironically bring its wealth and lay it down at the true king's feet. So,
yeah. I'm sorry. I thought I was on the wrong side.
Oh.
Looking at this, and I like his comment about the football, but when the Bible discussed Christians being persecuted,
mm-hmm.
God's providential knowledge knew that persecuting Christians would push them to other places and
sure.
things of those nature, but the children of Israel didn't. So when I look at that in the providence of it,
mm-hmm.
all I see as I continue to look in the biblical stories are the nations being born.
Right.
And they're allowed to live it out so that then they'll be judged.
Right.
Start, beginning, end, right?
Right.
So in these situations, the children of Israel didn't know they were going through what they were going through. We can look back at it and see through Isaiah and other things what it is.
Well, sure.
But they didn't know that. So we
well, that's what part of what the prophet's job was to do, was explain to them what they were going through so they had the right perspective on it.
Got it.
So,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So what we're going to do for sake of time, we're not going to have time to look at all of 13 through chapter 20 and verse 6 tonight. I'm going to hit the big one, though, for a bit, though, which is 13 and 14, the judgment of Babylon and Assyria, for a couple of reasons. Number one, some of the language there becomes used in the New Testament, but people think it's the end of the world. But when you see it's used here, you realize this language doesn't necessarily mean the end of the world. It means the end of the world as the people going through that judgment knew it. Just like we can't imagine a world without the United States, they couldn't imagine a world without themselves being king of the mountain. And so it's the end of the world as they know it, which is why the language gets to be so dramatic. And so that's number one. Number two, Babylon becomes the stereotypical bad guy in the Bible. It is fascinating, right? Chapter 13, verse 1, we've just been dealing with Ahaz and the Assyrian crisis, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, 13, verse 1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which I say the son of Amos saw. And you say, wait a second. You know, at this point, it's like, you know, Babylon's a nobody. It's, you know, trying to predict what world power, you know, let's assume the United States is in decline right now. Which is not an unreasonable assumption, for a variety of reasons. It is, well, yeah, the truth of the matter is it is. It's just some of us are slow to wake up to that. But, so 200 years from now, what great power is going to be dominating the world? The American century is over. We're in decline. What great power? And that's basically what Isaiah is doing right here. Think about it. What Isaiah is doing is talking about the destruction of a world power that isn't even a world power yet. You know, and so, you know, imagine the original ears even hearing what Isaiah is about to do here. Because, you know, it's like me sitting here and talking about, you know, God is going to bring judgment upon Zimbabwe. And we sit here and say, that's just a weak country and a way out of the way place. Well, so was Babylon at the time. You with me? And so, again, the powers, and this is part of what's going to become clear later in the book. Part of what God says through Isaiah to his people of all eras, why you should be listening to me, I know the future before it happens. And so when I start telling you stuff, and it seems like it's, you know, you got to be kidding me. Remember, as the world, as they lived in the world back then, Babylon is kind of on the edge of the map. Just like some third world country I might pick today that's at the edge of the map as we think about the world. It's not part of the, you know, American and European economic axis. And yet, that's what God is up to. And so, the power of the future. Secondly, Babylon becomes a much greater threat. And here's the irony. Ahaz is shaking his boots over Assyria. But Babylon actually becomes a far greater threat than Assyria ever was, right? Why? Because Babylon actually does what Assyria tried to do and failed, which is take Jerusalem and destroy the temple. And so that's the irony, is your problem that you think is your problem isn't really your problem, God is saying, which is all the more why you ought to be listening to me. And number three, Babylon in the Bible, and this goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, all the way to the book of Revelation, so literally from Genesis to Revelation. Babel or Babylon is the image throughout the Bible of the quintessential city of man and rebellion against the purposes of God. And even in Genesis chapter 11, Babel in Hebrew is exactly the same. It's written the exact same, spelled the same way as Babylon later. Because of history, we use the different names, but in Hebrew, it's all the same. Babel in Genesis 11 is the Babel of Daniel, the Babel here, the Babel. That is, it's all spelled the same and pronounced the same in Hebrew. And that's part of the point, is what God is saying is that the quintessential human rebellion located in a place, in a city. Because what happened in Babylon? We always talk about the tower. It wasn't just the tower. What did they do in Babylon? They said, let us make a name for ourselves. And in the Bible, you want God to be doing the name and not you, right? Who names Adam? God does. Who names Israel? God does. Who names Christians? God. You with me? You want to be the named by God, not the making a name for myself. And by the way, part of the power of Genesis, some of you have heard this before, but if you haven't, part of the power of the way Genesis tells the story, the quintessential act of human rebellion up to that point, we'll build a city and we'll make a name for ourselves, two things that God does in response. Turn the page, the very next thing God does is he calls Abram. What does he say to Abram? I will make a name for you, though. And he even changes his name as the story goes on. But part of naming him is naming him the father of a nation, because that's literally his name change. He's just Abram, father before that. Abraham, in Hebrew, is people. And so he literally names him the father of a nation. And of course, all that falls out of that. And then the next thing God does coming out of that is at the end of the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy, as Israel's about to go into the promise, and he tells Moses, you should worship me in the city where I place my name. So Babel wanted a name. God says, I'll put the name where I want it. That's Bible in a nutshell right there. So Babylon matters and on so many levels in the way that Assyria does it, which goes back to, again, you got to listen to God. God knows what the real problems are. And of course, in the one sense, part of why God allows Babylon to take his people, not Nineveh, doesn't let Nineveh last another couple centuries and be the people to do it, is because God wants to keep, as he runs history, this clear image of what the real struggle is. It's not about an earthly Babylon, which is why throughout the New Testament, the word Babylon is recycled for other cities. They're just metaphorically called Babylon, chiefly Rome. Peter calls Rome Babylon. Why does he do that? Because it's always Babylon, if you understand what the real thrust of the story is. The quintessential city of man, whether it's Nineveh, Babylon, Rome, it's always about the rebellion against God. That's always localized in some city, some nation. And Babylon becomes the worst of them all in this era. So, on a bare hill, raise a signal. Cry aloud to them. Wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones. I have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. Now, this is the beginning of the shocking language about Babylon in Isaiah. So he starts by calling these Babylonian warriors, these are his consecrated ones. I've summoned my mighty men. The sound of a tumult is on the mountains as of a great multitude. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. The Lord of hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from a distant land, from the end of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the holy. But all of a sudden, it's actually not for Jerusalem after all. It's actually for Babylon. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come, and therefore all hands will be feeble, every human heart will melt. For any of you who have been kind of rattled by the events of the past 24 hours, and I know some of you are, it's on everybody's mind, this is part of what happens when great events begin to happen in history. Everybody looks at the news and says, my heart melts. I wonder where this is going, how bad will this get? Nothing new about that. This is what happens. When the wheels of history begin to turn in some way, and how far they turn, nobody knows unless a prophet comes to tell you. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. Therefore, all the hands will be feeble. Every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pains and agony will seize them. They will be like in anguish, like a woman in labor. That woman in labor motif, Jesus uses that. In the Gospels, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. And here's the language that looks like the end of the world, except it's not. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising. The moon will not shed its light. And I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. Stop right there for a second. Because it is the end of a world. And it's not just the end of a world for Babylon. Think about this. Even if you're not Babylon, and it's not your city, your territory, literally being run over by, in this case, the Medes and Persians, it still affects, it's still the end of the world even for the edges of an empire that aren't directly militarily affected. Why? Because part of what makes an empire is who do you pay your taxes to. And so even if I'm not being run over, you know what I have to do? I have to kind of change where I mail the check. It's no longer the IRS in, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina. It's, you know, it's, you change where you make the check out to. It's still, you know, whose stamp do you use? Whose money do you use? See how this works? It's still the end of a world even for those who are not literally dying in it. A world, a way of organizing politics and reality and the economics for everybody changes. And so it does feel like the end of a world. Some of us who are old enough to remember 9/11, we talk about, you know, the world before and the world since, right? Because the world since 9/11, for those of us who are old enough to remember and have lived a bit in the world before 9/11, security was different. Banking was different. I don't have to give my social security number for everything I do. Right? Remember those days? Didn't have to show your ID for as much. I mean, just, man.
5 minutes to get on the plane.
Took, yeah, yeah.
5 minutes.
I got on the plane without being ID'd from the curb to the gate and on the plane. Never got ID'd. That's how it used to be. That world's gone. The end of an age. You know, and so on and so forth. So again, nothing new about this. This is a common human experience. But this is God's doing. And in this case, Babylon, it's the end of the world and the Babylonian age. I will make people more rare than fine gold in mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I make the heavens tremble and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And like a hunted gazelle or like a sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people, each will flee to his own land. Whoever is found will be thrust through, and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. All of a sudden, the Babylonian version of the United Nations, you know, everyone's running back for their home territory, but it's not going to work. The infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Why is that verse interesting as applied to the Babylonians in particular? Anybody know? Psalm 137. When the Jews lament the fall of Jerusalem by the rivers of Babylon, they were asked to sing a song of Zion for the amusement of the Babylonian captors. They basically, how can we sing a song of Zion in a foreign land? And then they get personal. What you guys did to us. And one of the things the Babylonians did to them, smashed their babies on the rocks. God is a God of justice. And so what's the image of Babylonian destruction? What they did to others is now done to them. Their children are the ones smashed on the rocks before their eyes. Verse 17, behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them. The Medes who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. Why does God throw that line in?
Because they're not going to be bought off.
They're not going to be bought off. Think about it. What's Ahaz trying to do with Egypt? What are a number of Judean kings as these next few decades roll by and the troubles begin to mount? What are they going to do over and over again? They go into the temple, they raid the treasure, they strip the silver and the gold, and they give it to whoever's knocking on the door to please go away. Why is that a bad news for Babylon? They can't be bought off. Because, you know, they'll take the silver and gold after you're dead. They don't need you to buy off. They don't mind spending a little blood to get your treasure. And so there is no, and so what it is, it's an image of hopelessness. The ancient version of diplomacy will not work.
Throwing out food for wolves.
Well, ironically, yeah. I mean, that's,
same thing.
That's just it.
They're going to come back.
Yeah. Or feeding cats.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's right. That's right. As they have no regard, they don't delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pomp of the Chaldeans. And why does he emphasize that? Well, up to that point in human history, Babylon was one of the greatest cities that man had yet built. In fact, to this day, through Herodotus, we talk about the seven ancient wonders of the world. And what was one of them? The Hanging Gardens of Babylon. You know, what does Nebuchadnezzar himself in the book of Daniel say as he's walking around looking at things? Yes, look at Babylon. And he just kind of goes, all the adjectives start piling up. That I have built. Yeah. And God doesn't deny it was a tremendous city. But it will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. And the idea is more Bedouins. You know, even the Bedouins won't, you know, who move around in tents and pasture there. And by the way, to this day in that part of the world, there are still Bedouins. You go, you know, Israel, the Jordan, over to Saudi Arabia. To this day, the Bedouin lifestyle exists. You can see it as you're driving around. Even the Bedouins won't go there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. But wild animals will lie down there, and their houses will be full of howling creatures. Their ostriches will dwell, and their wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers, and jackals in the pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand, and its days will not be prolonged. And what's stunning about that is, to this day, ancient Babylon, I mean, that literally is true to this day. To this day, ancient Babylon is literally just a ruin in the Iraqi desert. To this day, you can go out there and see the ruins that archaeologists have dug up, and nothing, you know, nobody lives there. It's not a city anymore. It is literally the place of wild animals. And so Babylon is doomed. Again, God's calling this before they've even risen to power. We'll talk about why, a little bit more about why he does that in a minute. Let's read a little bit more, though. Chapter 14. For the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and will again choose Israel. And will set them in their own land, and sojourners will join them and will attach themselves to the house of Jacob. And the peoples will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in the Lord's land as male and female slaves. They will take captive those who were their captors and rule over those who oppressed them. So God will flip the tables in time. And when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and the hard service with which you were made to serve, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressed has ceased, the insolent fury ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers that struck the peoples in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger and with unrelenting persecution. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth in the singing. We get rid of these power mongers, maybe the earth would have some peace for a change. It's the ambitious people who always make a mess of things. The cypresses rejoice at you, the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were laid low, no woodcutter comes up against us. That kind of lumber, serious lumber, high-quality lumber, was the metal of the ancient world. Now we make, you know, planes and tanks out of metal. In the ancient world, they made chariots, siege engines out of the wood. And so basically the trees are happy that the king of Babylon's gone, because now no one's come to chop us down and make us into chariots and siege engines anymore. Sheol, on the other hand, Sheol beneath us stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you, all who were leaders of the earth. It raises from their thrones all who were kings of the nations. And all of them will answer and say to you, so this is kind of like a welcoming committee to the king of Babylon in hell. All of them will answer and say to you, you too have become as weak as we are. You've become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of your harps. Maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. And that's in, for sake of time, in the ancient world, that's a reference to deity. He wanted to be God, is basically what it's saying. That's a loaded phrase there. So I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But when you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit, those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Here's what all the other shades and ghosts in hell will say to themselves as they look at the king of Babylon as the new arrival. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms? He made the world like a desert, overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home. All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast out away from your grave, like a loathed branch, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a dead body trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land, you have slain your people. And of course, that's part of the problem with dying the way Belshazzar and Nabonidus died, is when you're the end of the line, nobody buries you and makes a pretty tomb for you. You know, that's the whole point. You lost the most important battle of your nation's history. You lie dead pretty much where you fell because the new power brokers aren't going to allow a reverential tomb to be built for you. But think about what they're saying. You've become like one of us. You thought you were God, and now you're dead. And in death, you're no different than the kings you defeated because you're as weak and powerless and irrelevant to the affairs upstairs, as it were, as we are. It's a powerful commentary on the foolishness of earthly power. I remember, I sometimes heard me tell this story, but it really provoked, you know, this kind of stuff always promotes me back to a memory. Two or three summers ago, we took the kids, we went out to Fredericksburg, out that area, went to the LBJ Ranch. You know, the Western White House, as it was called at that time, because LBJ, you know, would do a lot of stuff out there, put the airstrip in and so forth. And of course, now it's a National Historic Park, and you can go there and see all sorts of things. But one of the most interesting things to me was, you know, they still got some of the old Secret Service checkpoints and stuff there. And, you know, so you just, so it's interesting. You walk around this, what basically is the front yard that goes up to the Pedernales River there. That was 60 years ago, some of the most protected real estate on earth. And not just because LBJ was there, but remember, he famously would hold summits there on occasion. And there was one marker that had pictures that I was referencing when the German chancellor and some other world leaders came to the Western White House and ate barbecue with LBJ, and the reporters named it the Spare Rib Summit. You know, a great little historical piece on all that. And there were pictures in this you know, placard that was marking all that. What was fascinating was it, and one of the things they did was they served barbecue and had a mariachi band and some other things out on the banks of the river in front of his house. A bunch of old oak trees out there. And you can look at the picture and see, because oak trees, you know, it takes a while for big oak trees to grow. And so you look at the picture and you see world leaders standing under those oak trees. And I look up off the placard, and you look over and you see those exact same oak trees are still there. So here I am, walking around among trees where I would have been shot dead as a trespasser 60 years ago. But the earthly power that was present there for that brief moment, literally the center of world power under those oak trees when the President of the United States walked there. And now where is he? Well, I can walk right up to his tomb. It's just a little bit over. He's unburied under one of those oak trees. I can walk right up to his grave and stand a few feet from one of the most, a man who in his own time was one of the most powerful men on the planet during the, you know, some of the heavy days of the Cold War. Nuclear power at his fingertips. And yet now, he's just a slab of rock under an oak tree, and I'm walking around on the property I would never have been included in before. It's funny how that works, isn't it? And all the people in those pictures, by all those world leaders who are gathering to talk about serious affairs of mankind, you know where all those people in those pictures are? They're all dead. They're all in Sheol. And the King of Babylon says, "Welcome to the club, LBJ." And every other American president. And the wheels of history keep going.
The cycle.
And God says to his people, "Why are you worried? Why are you worried about what these great kings of the earth think they're up to? They're all going to be in dust soon enough. The bed of maggots. You know, they live in such pomp and luxury, but in the end, they are food for worms. Just like you and me, no different. They just think they're different." Yes, sir.
It was promised. So when you say that the Bible, in a nutshell, the three promises made to Abraham is the entire Bible.
Yeah, pretty much.
I shouldn't say that out loud.
But it's working it out. Yeah, it's working it out.
It's just letting you see that no matter, there's a start, a middle, and a judgment. And it just keeps itself going.
That's right.
The Christians always win at the end.
That's exactly
That's
right.
why it keeps being shown.
That's right.
It's three things.
That's right. The problem is we still struggle with faith. that's the real plot point. It's not that, you know, God's at risk of losing. Right. It's why are we still not believing? That's the real story. So, all right, let's keep reading for sake of time. We're still, clock's chasing us, and we've got to get a little further. All right. Verse 21, "Prepare slaughter for his sons because of the guilt of their fathers, lest they rise and possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities." If we had more time, and we don't, there's something in verse 21, though, that's worth recognizing. He's going to have the sons die for the guilt of the fathers. You've got to understand part of what's going on here. God works in the corporate level differently than he works in the individual level. And that's one of the most crucial distinctions that's rarely explicitly expressed in the Bible, but simply assumes you get it. So think about it. Like elsewhere, even the Pentateuch, when God gives the law and talks to his own people, the iniquity of fathers will follow the sons of the third and fourth generation. What he means by this is not the individual guilt. I am not guilty of my father's sin. But the consequences, the guilt in that sense of my father's sin. I think somebody in this room's lived long enough, you know, maybe you had a father or a mother who did great evil in your family. And that affected, you know, caused you a lot of baggage that you brought into your own marriage or how you raised your own kids. Are you with me? And so in a sense, you bore the guilt. You suffered the consequences of. And so that's one of the things that's going on here. Verse 21, again, is playing with that. The sons are going to die, not so for their own sins, although probably just as sinful as their dads, being pagans. But the point is, the consequences of what the fathers have done is going to come crashing down on you. And that's part of how God runs the world, is that the guilt in the sense of consequences do span from generation to generation sometimes. All right. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off Babylon, name and remnant, descendants and posterity, declares the Lord. I will make it a possession of the hedgehog and pools of water. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. So strong final word. Now here's what's interesting. Here's what he does real quick then. Verse 24. The Lord has sworn, as I have planned, so it shall be. As I have purposed, so it shall stand. That I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains, and trample him underfoot. And his yoke shall depart from them, his burden from their shoulder. It's almost like what God is doing here real quick before he wraps up the global stuff and then goes to the local. And let me talk about Philistia. Let me talk about Moab. Let me talk about some of your, you know, let me talk about the problems in Austin. You know, once I get through talking about the problems in the world. It's almost like what he's doing here is, you know, he's talking about what their real problem's going to be, and not just because literally Babylon is the one that's going to take out Jerusalem, even though it hadn't even risen as a power yet, but also because Babylon represents the quintessential human risk to the people of God always, the persecuting and destroying power of the world that causes us to lose faith in the power of our God. It's always Babylon out there. And so he very much wants to work on that level. And it's almost like here in verses 24 to 28, oh, but by the way, because you're still living in your own particular time, Assyria is no big deal too. Because think about it, you know, who was the headline getter in their newspapers right then? It was Assyria. And what does Assyria get? Four verses. You know, by the way, verse 25, I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountaintops trample them underfoot. His yoke shall depart from them, his burden from their shoulder. This is the purpose, that is purpose, concerning the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations, for the Lord has opposed his purpose. That, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out. Who will turn it back? Oh, by the way, Assyria, not a big deal. And it wasn't. Right? Because we already saw a couple weeks ago when we linked, you know, the tale of two kings from Ahaz to Hezekiah. You know, it didn't happen in Ahaz's day like he was afraid of. And Hezekiah's day, it got close, but then what does God do because Hezekiah has faith? 185,000 soldiers in the night. We have one angel of God. God is not worried about what we are worried about. If he needs to deal with something, he has all kinds of means at his disposal to deal with it. And so again, you know, here we have that same taste of that. Oh, Assyria? Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot about that. That's what you're worried about. No, don't worry about that. I will break the Assyrian. And again, and look at it, in my land. If they come to my land, I'll snap them like a twig. All right. For sake of time, we're not going to look at what he says about Philistia, about Moab, and even about Damascus and Israel, for sake of time. Though, if you take time to, you know, I hope you do, to read them, one of the themes running all the way through, and you already, I hope, saw this in Babylon, but it wasn't just the big dog, it's the little dogs too. One of the themes that runs through almost all of these is the theme of pride. That the great problem of all these human regimes is they think they know what they're doing. And they think that they are capable of solving their own problems by their own cleverness, their own economies, their own money, their own military, or whatever. But they actually think they're in charge. They actually think that it's up to them to figure out solutions to their problems. As though, again, think about what God just said there in verse 24. As I have planned, so it shall be. As I have purposed, so it shall stand. We simply do not control history. That is the arrogance of the politicians of every age, every era, every empire. You know, you go to Georgetown in the School of Foreign Service to learn diplomacy, and you go to Harvard School of Government to learn public policy, and you know, and all that, you know, and study with the great leaders, because you know what happens to so many powerful politicians when they're voted out? They get some swanky lecturing gig at the Harvard School of Government. Right? I mean, that's how the world works. And you go and you go listen to these people who screwed up enough to lose their election. That's the only thing that kills me is you lost your office. So that why would the kids want to take a class from you? Just go write your memoirs and take your $3 million book deal.
Isn't that essentially the essence of human sin? I mean, you want to be like God
in some way,
good and evil. Right? And so we go all the way back to Genesis 3, and, we go through Genesis 11 with Babylon trying to make themselves great. Is it 11?
Yeah.
It is. And then here you have Isaiah, talking about Babylon again, and they're wanting to make themselves great, and we keep doing that. I mean, even the Jews did that to an extent. In Jesus' day, right? They were like, "Well, we want to be on top now," and so we keep suffering the same delusion of pride that we are something that we're not.
No, that's yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, we don't have time to explore this. I'm going to ask you to turn your Bible over to chapter 19. We're going to go look at Egypt here real quick in the last 5 minutes. But Eric's exactly right. This was a class on sin more properly, and whatnot. Pride seems to be the root of all sin, or at least most sin. All is always a tricky word, but I think you can just try to make a case for it. Simply because it's what pride, at the end of the day, here's God. He gives you life. He tells you what to do and how to live. For you not to do what the life giver tells you to do says one of two things. Either I think I'm smarter than him, or I don't need him. Either of those is a mistake. But that's a sin. If you think, those of you who raise kids, I think when your kids disobey you, why does your kid, and you bust them on it later. Generally speaking, almost any excuse your kid offers is going to be one of those two things. It's going to be either, I thought this would be better, I thought this would be the better way to do it, as the house burns down, or just there's an even more sinister there's a certain naivety in it that's not as fully rebellious as the larger I don't need you rebelliousness, right? The rebellion of the teenager who thinks they're ready for prime time on their own and doesn't realize that they're still on your health care plan, you're paying their insurance and they couldn't begin to afford on their own policy. In fact, they couldn't even get their own policy because, it's your credit that's taking the hit for their failures on the road. Anyways, okay. So, chapter 19. This brings us full circle. This is where we need to end today. Chapter 19. Let's go look at Egypt because, again, we've already talked about part of why Egypt fits into this portrait, but there's that line there that we saw, that we started with. We need to see that line in the context of what God's saying about Egypt. So, behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud. That image, by the way, that image sounds familiar of the Lord riding on a cloud. Yeah, it's Daniel. And that leads, and actually from Daniel it leads, because I think that's right, I think it's an image that's already used. Daniel tightens it. And then Jesus in his trial, that clock's not right then. But Jesus in his trial before the Jews, before he's crucified, are you the Christ or not? And what does he say? You will see the Son of Man riding on the clouds. What we often miss, we hear that, we want to think second coming. In the Bible, on the basis of the prophets, the coming of the divine one, the Son of Man, whoever, but the coming on the clouds is a coming in judgment. That's part of why they really got angry at Jesus when he said that on his trial. Because what they understood what he was saying. I'm going to come and destroy you. I'm going to come judge you. You want to know who I am? I'm the guy coming back to destroy you for what you're doing right now. So anyways, goes through all this stuff about, again, Egypt. I wish we had more time, but we don't. Go with me to the end of the chapter, because let's get to this point. As he eventually smacks Egypt down as well. And by the way, part of what's smacking Egypt, not just he judges sins, but also if he's going to crush Egypt, why from Ahaz on down, why are the kings of Jerusalem going to Egypt for help? They're going to be in trouble too. But he says this in this, verse 16, in that day, we're really coming full circle to where we started. Something, kind of more messianic beyond the actual destruction, the punishments of Egypt on earth in politics, in military history. In that day, the Egyptians will be like women, tremble with fear before the Lord of hosts who shakes over them. The land of Judah will become a terror to the Egyptians. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will fear, because the purpose of the Lord of hosts is purpose against them. And again, further destruction against Jerusalem or Egypt. But in that day, verse 19, part of Egypt and other nations' reclamation. In that day, there will be an altar to Yahweh in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord at its border. And there will be a sign of the witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. When they cry to the Lord because of oppressors, he will send them a savior and a defender and deliver them. And the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day and worship with sacrifice and offering. And they will make vows to the Lord and perform them. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking and healing. And they will return to the Lord, and he will listen to their pleas for mercy and heal them. And in that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Oh, there it is. And Assyria will come into Egypt, and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. And in that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth. Then the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. What he's given there when his highway comes back, and we saw that at the end of chapter 11, in the time of the Messiah, God is going to judge the nations, but then the righteous remnant even out of the nations, not just Jews. What's he talking about? Well, go to the book of Acts. Righteous Gentiles among the nations, as God destroys and obliterates both within history and at the end of history, there will be a highway even through the nations that runs to Jerusalem, and even a remnant from among the nations that will find their way. And now we're back to Isaiah chapter 2 again, right? In that day, all the nations of the world will come to the mountain of the house of the Lord. It's another aspect of that theme in Isaiah. All right, we're done. We'll read up through chapter 27 if you want. If you're looking for something to read, read up through chapter 27, and we'll see if we can make it that far on Wednesday.
How far?
Chapter 27.